Okay, hi everyone. Namo myoho renge kyo. We're going to delve into a tiny bit of scholarship here outside of the Gosho, because as I'm going through the current Gosho, the Tripitaka, Shanwu Wei, Nichiren is diving into a lot of historical context for the canon of Buddhism. And he is about to mention something called the 12 divisions. And that refers to some Pali school and early divisions of the canon, the scriptures. So I thought it was important to do a video just on this, because I talk about study a lot, and since Nichiren specifically nails a term here on the subject of study, because it's a critique he's giving of some of the other scholars and teachers of his day and previous to his day, that he's demonstrating where they may have gone awry, where they've stopped and they've only selected certain parts of the canon to focus on, and therefore, although they're still Buddhist studies, they're misleading because they cut off the entirety of the study, the reason for the study. It's like they study the joke without ever getting to the punchline. It's a bad analogy, but you know what I mean? So I'm going to talk today about the 12 divisions. And I found several sources online, and in that regard, I'll put up a little picture here of my study page, my resource site on the web, threefoldlotus.com. And if you follow the links for course study material, starting from the first page, you'll end up on home/home.html. And that has, I think, over 50 links to specific documents like this that I've either created myself as study information and deeper dives into concepts, or things I've found on the internet that I use as part of my study information. You'll find it all there, on everything from what is chanting to deeper things like this. And I'm going to pretty much read straight from this because it's pretty succinct, which we all know I don't tend to be, but I'll elaborate if I see the need. This particular site had an interesting introductory chapter that spoke about something I don't hear much a lot of. So I'm just going to read this first part, because a lot of you have had questions. I've had comments and questions sent to me about, you know, what happened between the time that Shakyamuni Buddha died and this 400 or 500 years passed before there's any documentation of anything. Well, that's not correct. So I'm going to read this little part here so that you have a better understanding of how the teachings, the written teachings, evolved, where they came from. Okay, so Tripitaka or Tipitaka, depending on the Pali or Sanskrit that you're reading, is the collection of teachings of the Buddha over 45 years. It consists of sutra, the conventional teaching, vinaya, the disciplinary code, and the abhidharma, or commentaries. So you may have heard these words in other sources or contexts. You'll get a better definition here of what those terms mean. The Buddha has passed away, but the sublime Dharma, which he unreservedly bequeathed to humanity, still exists in its pristine purity. That's an important point, because in today's world, we transfer knowledge by documents, and videos like this are tend to be taken at face value for someone's opinion, which I offer plenty of. But I always base my opinion on documentation. And I've had questions in the past of, yeah, we're reading this sutra, but are these the words of Buddha? So that's something I also answer on my website. There's resources there, but they touch upon it here. And what they're saying, pristine purity, you'll understand as we go on. The Buddha taught verbally, and the way people learned in his day, the sermons were repeated like a song, and people memorized the songs, the sermons. And by memorizing them, they not only rehearsed or relearned everything that the Buddha said, but they learned the lesson for themselves. Because one thing you'll notice in all of the sutra is it's constantly self-referential. I did this. I did that. I, at this time, I did that. Thus, everything starts with, thus I heard. So to the point that they, in those days, memorized what was being said to them, they took complete identification of it by beginning by saying, thus I heard, or I heard this. Everything depends on the translation. So that when you rehearsed it and you memorized it, you were telling yourself, this is me, this is... Remember, I keep telling you, sutra instruction by Buddha was a mental exercise. So he taught it in a form that everyone would exercise it in their own mind for themselves. This was not something outside the self. This gets repeated over and over again throughout the teachings. So the point of this is that although he left no written recordings or documents of his teachings, his distinguished disciples preserved them by committing them to memory and transmitting them orally from generation to generation. So when people, that set of disciples that followed him around and heard his sermons and memorized them and repeated them all day, when they shared them with others, when they traveled abroad, when they shared and taught these same sermons, they didn't say, well, you know, what he's saying in essence is, no. They recited word for word what they were told, and so on. So this is how the chain of sermons became, as they say, pristine, pure. They didn't get altered. See, that's very different than the way we do things today. So this goes on. Here's a brief historical background. Immediately after the final passing away of the Buddha, 500 distinguished arhats held a convention known as the First Buddhist Council to rehearse the doctrine taught by the Buddha. Venerable Ananda, who was a faithful attendant of the Buddha and had the special privilege of hearing all the discourses by the Buddha ever uttered, recited the sutra, whilst the venerable Upali recited the Vinaya, the rules of conduct for the Sangha. So, 100 years after the first Buddhist council, now we're 200 years after the passing, some disciples saw the need to change certain minor rules. Not the teachings, but the rules, how to behave in the monasteries, in the sangha, at that time was monastic. The Orthodox bhikkhus, the monks, said that nothing should be changed, while the others insisted on modifying some of the disciplinary rules, the Vinaya, not the sutras. Finally, the formation of different schools of Buddhism germinated after this council. And the second council, only matters pertaining to the Vinaya were discussed, and no controversy about the Dharma was reported. So the sutra stayed completely intact, but the rules of behavior for the practicants, the Sangha, those in many ways were challenged and adopted. And these became sects. So in the Hinayana, the early stages of Buddhist schools after the Buddha's passing, there was a proliferation of sects, all deviating not in the teaching, but in the behavior of the monks. In the 3rd century BC, Now, this is so this is 3 centuries after 2 centuries. Yeah, in the 3rd century after the Buddha's passing, during the time of Emperor Ashoka, the 3rd council was held to discuss the differences of opinion held by the Sangha community. At this council, the differences were not confined to the Vinaya, but were also connected to the Dharma, or the Sutra, the teachings. The Abhidharma Pitaka was discussed and included at this council. The council, which was held in Sri Lanka, today Burma, in 80 BC, now this is 80 BC, that's 400, almost 500 years after the Buddha's passing, is known as the 4th council under the patronage of the pious king Vatagamini Abhaya. It was at this time in Sri Lanka that the Tripitaka was first committed to writing in the Pali language. So, to those who would say, well, nothing happened between the death and the Tripitaka, what they're missing is all these other councils that were assembled in order to document the teachings from the get-go, so nobody would forget the identical words of the sutras, right? Evidently, controversy over 500 years, people change. Their capacities grow. And not just over 500 years, but just over your own lifetime, as you study more and more, insights and so forth give you better understanding of the meaning. And then some of the rules that are around don't apply anymore. They don't. They apply to early practicants who didn't have that depth of understanding and therefore didn't cultivate that capacity to understand the teachings and life in general at a different level. So you can see how this changes over time, but not the teaching, but what happens in sects. Sects who adopt a different paradigm for study and their own insights start to take latitude with the teachings. And so this is where things start to get sometimes misguided simply by omission, because they don't like something, they don't see that it applies to them, and they leave it out. Or they start adding their own commentaries, which we'll cover here. And this is how the transmission of Buddhism goes through this roller coaster of purity and then additions, and then stripping away those additions, getting back to purity, and then more additions. It goes throughout centuries through this purification process. Okay, so the Sutra Pitaka, or the Sutra Pitaka in Sanskrit, consists mainly of discourses delivered by the Buddha himself on various occasions. So the sutras are sermons. They're Buddha's own words. I like discourses. It's more, it's less religiously affiliated. Words are funny that way. Okay. I try to be mindful of that, but you know, I'm also a Westerner. So, there are also a few discourses delivered by some of his distinguished disciples like Shariputra, Ananda, Moggallana, sorry, my art background fell in there a minute. It's like a book of prescriptions, as the sermons embodied therein were expounded to suit the different occasions and the temperaments of various people, their capacities. There may be seemingly contradictory statements, but they should not be misconstrued, as they were opportunely uttered by the Buddha to suit a particular purpose. So this is expedient means. The Tripitaka is divided into 5 Nikayas, or collections. We don't need to go over those. What we want to get to is... Now, I have this online, so although I'm skipping some of it because I don't think it's pertinent to our discussion right now... this is online, so you can read this entire document and use it as a launching, a springboard to dive deeper into any of these, because they're all identified by name, and you can go on the internet and start digging one by one. Be mindful of the sources, because there are a lot of, again, this is just like Buddhist teachings, right? There are a lot of opinions out there from whence things happened and what they actually mean and so on and so forth. So collect as many as you can. Don't just rely on one source is what I'm saying. Okay, so now we'll get to the part 12 divisions of the Buddhist canon. And I find this quite fascinating because in Hinayana or teachings, they only have 9 divisions, and they leave out a lot of the Mahayana portions. And in the Theravada schools, I believe they use a similar thing where they had, I don't know, I think they may have 11 or 10. At any rate, they also have a selective division inclusion. The reason I wanted to do this is because Nichiren specifically calls out the 12 divisions as he's talking to these other Mahayana schools who haven't evidently done that. And so you can see by Nichiren, he's all inclusive, just as Shakyamuni was to begin with. Study the entire thing. Don't just stall out on arithmetic without learning algebra. So, the content of Buddhist canons is divided into 12 divisions, categorized by the types of forms of literature, whether they're sutra, gaya, or gatha, and maybe I should describe those to you. And the context, i.e. all of the other 9 divisions, it is known as the 12 divisions. Okay. So, yeah, we're going to describe all of that. The first is the sutra, or sutta in Pali. These are short, medium, and long discourses expounded by the Buddha on various occasions. The whole Vinaya Pitaka is also included in this respect. So, this is written from a perspective of Tripitaka study. So, this is why he keeps referring back to that. But sutra, as you and I know, because this is what we talk about, and the Gosho, which is Nichiren, not Shakyamuni, the sutra are short, medium, long discourses expounded by the Buddha, like the Lotus Sutra, for instance. Gaya, or Gaya in Pali, is the metrical pieces. These are discourses or prose mixed with the gathas or verses. So they distinguish between prose and verse. When you read the sutra, Lotus Sutra for instance, you'll see that they constantly go from a dialogue, a discourse, and they jump, not every one of them, but most of them jump to stanzas, either prose in some sort of a rhythmic effect, or actual gathas, or what do they call them in here? Verses, which are brief kind of prose that kind of condense the meaning of what he was talking about, and sometimes quite different words. So you can get insights from reading that you didn't get from reading through the discourse, right? So the Buddha did this a lot, Shakyamuni did this a lot when he was teaching, because he would have a big long thought and then he would want to somehow surmise it to make it a nice, what did we call it today? A soundbite that would kind of gel the idea. So they distinguished those different things in the 12 divisions as a study in itself. And the gatha, verses, chants, or poems, these included verses formed in the Dharmapada, etc., and those isolated verses which are not classified amongst the sutra. So they might not be in a complete discourse, they might be a side note of sorts, or a teaching that was done in a brief form as one of those sound bites, see? For like mantras. All right, Nidana, which I've been talking about a lot lately, the 12-link causal chains of formation. The Nidana are identified here as an area of study in itself, the causes and conditions of the Buddha's teachings. Okay, throughout the teachings, there are illustrations in his discussions of how things can come to be and how to perhaps disassemble them. The formations of things in the universe come up a lot in the sutra and outside of the sutra in different ways. They can be very small, they can be very personal, they can be very grandiose. We'll talk more about that. The Itivritaka, the sutras in which the Buddha tells of the deeds of their disciples and others in previous lives. So, translation, previous lives. You should know by now, they're not necessarily actual lives. Sometimes they are because, he's discussing actual personages and people in the history of his town in India or the folklore of town. So he's defining and talking about those particular people. But in general, when he's talking about previous lives, he's talking about previous to human life in the universe, the way formations work from the get-go. And this is always, or I should say, because I haven't read everything, this is indicative of his teachings for people to understand that hunger, for instance, let's be more specific, wanting to eat is not something invented by them, by this human that I'm talking to right now. The need to eat food is something that's descendant from previous lives, previous humans, pre-human, in the formations of tendencies and conditions, attachments, need. How atoms come together is a form of eating. How cells divide and become more and then feed on. Where do they get their energies? See, what feeding yourself is about a transfer of energy, caloric intake to burn, to create energy, so on and so forth. So every time you get into these areas where he's talking about previous to now, he's trying to explain in different ways how the forces of life work, how the forces of the universe work, how physics works, but there were no physics then. They talked about physics. They invented number systems and math long before modern people. They used it to set up a calendar, to count seasons, to know when to plant. I mean, there was a lot of sophistication that we take for granted that is ancient. So the idea that the Buddha would talk about these very elaborate scientific, really, concepts, but try to put them into layman terms, because he was very committed to communicating with the masses, not with the elite, not with just the Brahmin class, not with just the PhDs, if you will, but so that the lawnmower, the guy or the ladies who just stayed home all the time. He wanted to be able to speak in their language, which at that time was specifically different than the languages that the more educated or the elites used, right? So, that's a lot on previous lives, but it's very confusing to the modern reader who's not used to reading through this kind of teaching, this kind of way of alliterating. Jataka, stories of the former lives of Buddhas. These are the 547 birth stories. Okay, that's interesting because as we learn in the Lotus Sutra, it's not until the Lotus Sutra that, and this is a major, major aha moment in the Buddhist teachings, in the Dharma, in the entire canon of Buddhism, when in the 15th or 14th or 16th chapter, 15th or 16th chapter, depends on the translation that you read. Some translations of the Lotus Sutra, I think Kern's translation has 27 chapters, whereas many of the others have 28 and so on. But in the lifespan of the Tathagata, the lifespan of the Buddha chapter of the Lotus Sutra, he nails that he wasn't born in the lifetime that they're now experiencing with him, that he's been around since time immeasurable. He's not talking about him with the one nose, one mouth, two eyes, 2 feet. He's not talking about the Shakyamuni. He's not talking about Siddhartha. He's talking about Buddha as this mind state, which now, up until the Lotus Sutra, even though the Lankavatara Sutra and the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, a lot of time is spent analyzing how the mind works. That Buddha mind isn't attached to a human entity. It's a state of being that goes all the way back to the Big Bang, if you will, about formations in the first place, pre-formations. So prior Big Bang, pre-formations, the Buddha mind clarity is extant. Now that's huge. Don't get confused with eternity and eternal life. It's not eternal life. It's a clarity of how life forms and all of its attendant properties. That's the awakening of Buddhism. It's hard to understand. We can talk about it intellectually. That's what this is. The Jataka are specific talks that Shakyamuni had with his disciples about these 547 separate births. So this is him impersonating that Buddha mind and saying how he once lived in the time of da-da-da. But the he that he's using is a bit of a trick. It's an expedient device. Because for these people, these disciples that he was teaching, to understand the idea of a clarity of mind that, again, has a history that shows that it was always extant, they couldn't accept that their Buddha nature was there in their face and that they just didn't understand it. To them, that was insulting, quite frankly. So the Buddha took that on as a personage of his own, so that they could, again, they're so attached to that humanness, that human thing, the body, and the being of a person, Buddha, for them, had to be something that existed before in another society. So this was an expedient means to get them to start to understand the development of their own Buddha mind. And so these are very specific teachings, and they have a category of Jataka here. Then there's the Abhuta Dharma, the, for lack of a better word, miracles, or the amazing feats of. These are the few discourses that deal with the wonderful and inconceivable powers of the Buddha. So when the Buddha was first enlightenment, he started talking about, hey man, this enlightenment is incredible. It's like it has this quality, that quality, that quality. And to the people he spoke to, that just sounded magical. Wow. It was like his tongue was 300 miles long, and it was like he could see around the planet 17 times or into distant universes, things that we could never see. The third eye thing is about seeing, but it's not about seeing with visual consciousness. It's about seeing with understanding context and deeply integrating enlightenment, insight, okay? So there's all kinds of, excuse me, all kinds of language devices in here. The avadana, the parables, the metaphors, the illustrations used to facilitate human beings to understand the profound meanings of the Buddhist Dharma. Dharma is often shown as an alternate word being teaching, but it's more than teaching. Dharma is really about being in it and experiencing this clarity of understanding and of the nature, the true nature of all things, suchness. So we know parables because there are specific parables like the medicine, the doctor with the three sons, and how they got a little wacko and the two took the medicine, but one of them refused, and the doctor had to leave and pretend he was dead and send a messenger back so the third son would finally be so remorseful that he would take the medicine to join his father. He thought he was killing himself by taking medicine, and then he got better, and then the father came back. And the son was joyous that he had finally taken the darn medicine, and now all three sons survive. So this is a parable of incorrigible disbelief in the third son, Ichantika. You know, so there's constantly throughout, and the more sutra you read, the more you'll feel this rhythm, and you'll get into it, and it's very joyous, actually, and entertaining. What the avadana is about. The upadesa are dogmatic treatises, the discourse and discussions by question and answers regarding the Buddhist doctrines. It's also a synonym for the Abhidharma Pitaka. So you've heard of the Abhidharma. Now you've seen, as I read through the Gosho, Nichiren adopts this a lot. He'll be discoursing along or writing along in a Gosho, and then suddenly he'll pop into question, answer, question, answer. It's a form of teaching. So that falls under the upadesa. The adana, impromptu or unsolicited addresses. So a lot of times the Buddha would be traveling about, and a certain crowd would amass where he spent the night maybe. And he'd get up, and instead of a full-blown sermon, he and everybody was packing up ready to move, and he'd say, or somebody from the town before he spent the night would come in and ask him a question, and there were several of his disciples were all around, always around, and he would just break into a story or a teaching. It wasn't formalized, in other words. And so, you know, his disciples, they learned these too and recited them and kept them memorized, and so they shared those. That part of his teachings are the Udana. The Vaipulya is an interpretation by elaboration or deeper explanation of the doctrines. That's kind of what I spend my time doing, right? But this is specific to the Buddha. It is the broad school or wider teachings in contrast with the narrow school. The term covers the whole of the specifically Mahayana sutras, like, for instance, there's some listed on this other document that I liked. Yeah, Sanskrit tradition places here as Vaipulya a number of important Mahayana works, including the Lotus Sutra, the Atashat Srika Prajna Paramita, and the Lankavatara Sutra, which I really got a lot out of, and I reference it several times in my in my videos. And from the Lankavatara, to me, that was the first sutra where he really, really nailed down the mental component of Buddhist practice. And that sent me to the collection of Perfection of Wisdom sutras. Nagarjuna wrote those down. And those are amazing. Those are very eye-opening. For me, I'm very visual, but I'm also quite cerebral, and I can get lost in my own mind. So it was really nice to read about how that whole mess works and traps us and liberates us and so forth. So that's all included in the Vaipulya. And then the Vyakarana or Vyakarama in Pali. It's almost the same. Those are predictions and forecasts and by the Buddha of the future attainment of Buddhahood by his disciples. So those are encouragements really to his disciples who would say, well, I'll never achieve this. And he'd say, no, you will through this, through that practice, you will. I see that becoming, blah, blah, blah. And he'd give them names and all of that. Gave them something less ethereal for them to grasp onto, to give them, to create the resolve toward our Buddhahood, our Buddha nature. And this was very important, more so before the Lotus Sutra, but in the Lotus Sutra he does it as well, because in the Lotus Sutra he really lays it down and goes, this is for you right now to get this Buddha. And this is where a lot of his disciples, who were fervent disciples and students, thought, wait a minute, Buddhahood is here now? It's for me to grasp at this? Oh, man, there's no way. They spent their whole life thinking this was something outside their realm of being. And in the Lotus Sutra, Shakyamuni says, if you don't know by now, this is now. This is right now. Buddhahood is happening this moment. Your Buddhahood is here. You wouldn't be here without it. And for a lot of people, that was like inconceivable. So he would have to give them a story, name it for them, and put it in the future, even though that's moment to moment. The future could be 2 seconds from now, 2 years from now. Your Buddhahood is here for you to experience. It's not a question of the Buddhahood. It's a question of your revealing it, your perceiving it, your awakening to it, right? That was really tough for a lot of his followers. You think, 2,700 years ago, to think spiritually as a hermetic thing that already belongs and is a part of you, that's hard for us to do now, right? Especially in a culture, in a day and age when people are so fond of pointing the finger or waiting to be given, instead of understanding that it's, the Gohanzen does not exist outside yourself. It is within you, part of you, you, okay? So, the nine divisions, like I said earlier, leave out the Mahayana, I think it says here. Yeah, the term is generally referred to as Hinayana, or the small vehicle, and the Mahayana, the greater vehicle, right? There are only nine divisions, excluding the Udana, Vaipulya, and Vyakarana. However, there is also a Mahayana division of nine of 12 divisions, which don't have the Nidana, Avadana, and Upadesa. That would be your Theravada school, generally. They're not all the same. And I know everything I say here sounds very, how shall I say? Keep in mind that sectarianism is always going to be a debatable thing. Sects are debates. And so what Nichiren is always reminding us, as did Shakyamuni, is you have to study outside of sectarianism. You have to study the entire thing. Be your own sect, but judge your knowledge and experience of the teachings like you would your own life. Be all-inclusive. Don't listen to anybody. Don't follow the persons. Follow the law. Right? That's what that means. So, I think that's enough for now. You can, like I said, use the document, go online, go to threefoldlaws.com, find the button. It'll say 12 divisions of the scripture on the button. Click on the button. A PDF will open. You can print it out. You can read it online. It's not that long. But use it as a foundation document to take terms and go dig deeper. What does upada mean? Take it apart in the vernacular. What do different schools say about that, what it means to them? I mean, study to your delight. Study to the point where you feel you understand. Don't force it, but just, it may be that you study something and it just entertains you. Fine, leave it at that. Move on. Keep studying. It may be that you end up coming back to that same thing 4 or 5 years later, and it will have a completely different depth of meaning to you. That's why it's important. Don't do like you did in high school and break your head, staying up till 2 in the morning. Oh, man, I'm not going to get this. I'm not going to be ready for the test. Don't be like that. Unless it works for you. I have to be all inclusive here. I mean, there were moments when I did that with other subjects outside of Buddhism. But Buddhism can, I like to dig deeply into things because sometimes things won't make sense to me until I dig to the point where I can't stay awake. And then when I'm laying in bed and I can't fall asleep because my mind's going and thinking of all these things, it's usually about the time I go to sleep or when I wake up in the morning or during the night that I'll have these huge aha moments or sometimes occasionally, duh. You know, but that's the nature of our karma, the way that we perceive the world and our own lives within it, right? Same thing. So with that, I think I'm ready to go ahead and do part two of the Tripitaka Master Shanwu Wei. But I'll link them back and forth because this discussion is contained in a single sentence of that Gosho. And I want to make sure there's adequate reference for that as I read it. Anyway, thanks so much for listening. Truly appreciate your participating in these videos simply by watching. And anything else is gravy. So thank you. Namo myoho renge kyo. See you again.